I didn't feel sorry for myself. I'd shared a similar belief system in North Korea. Uncle Paul had grown up in a high Songbun family, but he'd ignored family advice, married the girl from the collective farm, and had sunk in the social scale. Kim could rebel against his parents, run away with me and marry me. We might even be happy for a year or two. But the romance would fade. The disappointment he had caused his family would gnaw at his conscience. Life with me would wear him down until, as I imagined had been so with Uncle Paul, he'd conclude that his marriage had been a big mistake. Kim had realized this before I had, probably when we were living in Shanghai, and had been trying to think of a way forward. "I want you to go to university," he said, driving me home after one of these nights out with the beautiful set. "If you could pass the exams to be a doctor or a pharmacist, it would really please my parents." I stared ahead and said nothing. I had not even been introduced to his parents. The next day, however, I investigated. The medical courses were expensive, and only the very brightest student passed the exams. Worse, the NIS had told me that because I'd left North Korea without graduating from secondary school, I would have to take a 2-year course to become sufficiently qualified merely to apply for college. This titanic effort to please Kim's parents would take a decade. In that summer of 2008, I watched the Beijing Summer Olympic Games on television with Kim and a large group of his friends at an apartment in Gangnam. When the South Korean athletes were winning, they cheered tumultuously, as did everyone watching in nearby apartments. I heard the roars rising across the whole neighborhood. They chanted, "Uinara," our country, and "Daehanmingu," Republic of Korea. I was cheering too, but I couldn't shout "Uinara." I tried to, because I wanted to fit in. But my heart went quiet, and the words wouldn't come out. My heart was rooting for North Korea. I was proud to see my country winning gold medals. But I couldn't cheer. North Korea was the enemy. Later, I turned down Kim's offer of dinner and went home to my little apartment, where I could still hear distant cheering and celebrations from the other blocks. The experience had depressed me. That night, I lay awake on my mattress, watching the reflected glow of the city on the clouds. The sky over Seoul was a thick amber broth that obscured the stars. In Haesan, I could see the Milky Way from my bedroom window. The Olympics sparked a full-blown identity crisis in me. It had probably been building for a while, fueled by the insecurity I was feeling over Kim, and by my lack of education. Am I North Korean? That's where I was born and raised. Or am I Chinese? I became an adult there, didn't I? Or am I South Korean? I have the same blood as people here, the same ethnicity. But how does my South Korean ID make me South Korean? People here treat North Koreans as servants, as inferiors. I wanted to belong, like everyone else around me did. But there was no country I could say was mine. I had no one to tell me that many other people in the world have a fragmented identity, that it doesn't matter, that who we are as a person is what's important. As if reaching for a well-thumbed book, my mind turned again to thoughts of going home to North Korea. But now that I was a South Korean citizen, it was illegal for me to go to the North. If I did go, at best, the North would parade me for propaganda purposes as someone who'd rejected the South. This happened with some people who decided to go home. At worst, I'd be imprisoned or shot. My mother could tell I was lonely and unhappy. I spoke to her every Sunday, but I did not want to burden her. She had worries of her own. Ever since armed troops had searched her house after I sent the money over with the 3 sacks, she'd been living under a cloud. The incident had drawn the attention of the Puibu, and whenever a crackdown was ordered from Pyongyang, she'd find herself on the list of people to be banished into internal exile in some remote mountain village. Each time she'd have to pay an enormous bribe to the investigators to have her name removed, but feared she could not go on doing this for much longer. Had they known the truth, that her daughter had defected to the South, they would have had no hesitation in arresting her and Mino. Life in Haysan was getting worse, she said, and hunger had returned. I began to feel desperate for her. Surely it was time for her to come to South Korea. Gently, each Sunday, I began to raise the possibility of her coming to Seoul. I will never, ever leave, she would say. Slowly, I pulled myself out of my despondency. I had taken such risks to get here. I couldn't give up now. I had made a promise to myself, on that bright morning on the way to Hanawon, that I would succeed in this country and make it proud of me. I would steel myself to succeed, no matter what. There would be no failure. After working very hard, I obtained my accounting qualification at the end of 2008. A law firm offered me a job with a monthly salary of 1.3 million won, about $1,200, a respectable sum. But after some thought, I turned it down. I figured that without a degree, I would never be able to move on to anything greater. I started to contemplate the grueling university entrance exam. By the time I qualified for university, I would be 30 years old. I would be 34 when I graduated. Could I do it? I posted the question in an online question forum. It provoked a lot of comments. It will be tough working alongside people 10 years younger than you, one said. Give it up and get a job, was another. Another common response was, your best bet is to get married. They might have added, before it's too late. The one person who encouraged me was Mr. Park. He really wanted me to succeed and encouraged me to go for it. Before applying, however, there was something I thought I should do. Get a new name. In Hanawon, I had heard about defectors whose family back home had been punished when the Puibu learned they were in the South. They were almost certainly spies among the defectors, who reported back to Pyongyang. For these reasons, many changed their names. This wasn't the only motive. Others did it because fortune tellers told them a name change would bring better luck. When I told Mr. Park I wanted to have a new name with a special meaning, he introduced a Changmyeonso, a professional name giver. I paid the lady 50,000 won, $45, and gave her my date of birth and the two parts of my given name. One of these names has brought you ill fortune, she said softly. I couldn't help smiling. I was thinking of my mother taking me to Daeochun all those years ago for a dawn reading with that grizzle-headed mystic. This one was more presentable, a middle-aged lady with a bubble perm. I immediately found myself in a familiar frame of mind when I watched her close her eyes. I thought the whole thing was ridiculous, yet I wanted to believe every word. I decided to help her. I'm always feeling cold. Yes, she said, taking the hint. Yes, you have a yin, not a yang constitution, so you need to warm yourself with a warm name. She presented me with five choices of name. I chose Hyunso. With this name, the strength of the sun will shine on you. But she warned me, this name is so strong it could bring you great fortune, or it could overpower you and bring great misfortune. Therefore, I suggest you also take a nickname to balance out the overwhelmingly positive force of Hyunso. No, I thought. No more names. Hyunso it is. In the summer of 2009, I applied to several universities under my new name. To gain an added credential, I started studying English from a textbook, but found it extremely difficult. If any universities were going to invite me for interview or to sit the entrance exam, they would do so in September and October. I would have to wait a few weeks. If they accepted me, my next few years would be divided predictably into semesters and vacations. But just as life was starting to feel settled and structured, I was pitched straight back into the abyss. Chapter 41. Waiting for 2012.
People may be hungry now,
my mother said. Her voice trailed off uncertainly.
But things will get better. We're all waiting for 2012.
I groaned. This date was the centenary of the birth of Kim Il-sung, now less than 3 years away. For years, party propaganda had been trumpeting it as the moment when North Korea would achieve its goal of becoming a strong and prosperous nation. I knew nothing but change, but how could she? She might grumble about life, but she had no perspective and still shared the regime's values. It is hard for outsiders to grasp how difficult it is for North Koreans to arrive at a point where they accept that the Kim regime is not only very bad, but also very wrong. In many ways, our lives in North Korea are normal. We have money worries, find joy in our children, drink too much, and fret about our careers. What we don't do is question the word of the party, which could bring very serious trouble. North Koreans who have never left don't think critically because they have no point of comparison with previous governments, different policies, or with other societies in the outside world. So my mother, along with everyone else, was waiting for the mythical dawn of 2012.
Omar, you said life there is getting worse. It will never happen, I said.
Listen, I've met so many North Korean families here. Usually, one person comes first. Then from here, they arrange to bring the rest of the family out.
I've seen too many executions of people who've tried to get out, she snapped. I don't want Minho jailed because of us. I don't want to be shot at Haesan Airport with your aunts and uncles sitting in the front row.
But Omar, life's so much better here. You can have whatever you like. The government gives us plenty of money to settle.
You said you weren't happy.
I was just moaning. My theme was starting to break her resistance. I haven't seen you in nearly 12 years. My 20s have come and gone and I never saw you once. I want to marry and have children. But what's the point if you'll never see us? If we don't do something now, we'll never meet again in our lives. There was a long pause, and I realized she was crying quietly. The thought of being separated forever was unbearable, she said. I kept the pressure up over 3 or 4 weeks.
Come for 18 months, I said. If you don't like it, you can always go home. It'll be easy.
I was lying, of course, but I had to convince her and I believed the lie was justified. We'd be reunited, and she would be able to live free from danger. I pushed this theme because she had already begun researching the process of getting the records changed to make it appear as if she'd never left. Still, she wavered. Then, a sensational event in Haesan changed her mind. Wanted posters went up all over the city with the face of a well-known party cadre, Seol Jun-sik, the provincial secretary for the Socialist Youth League. Soon the gossip was that he'd defected. Locals in Haesan were astonished. My mother thought,
if a big shot like Seol can leave, why can't I?
The timing could not have been better. On the Sunday after it happened, she came out with it.
I've made up my mind. I'll go.
She kept her language vague in case the Puibu was listening. She was nervous.
Will it be safe?
I almost yelled, I was so happy. I will make it 100% safe, I said, knowing this was a promise only the president of China could make.
Your brother won't go.
This brought me down to earth.
But he must. You must both come together. It'll be too dangerous for him to stay.
He'll be all right. He's got his own business. And he's going to marry Yoon-ji.
Marry?
This was news to me. I knew about Minho's business. He was smuggling in motorbikes. The Chinese models, Haojie and Shongxi. But sometimes also high-end Japanese brands. In summer, he would take the bikes apart and float them across the river on a raft. In the winter, he would ride them over the ice. He paid the border guards 10% of whatever he made and gave them cigarettes, Chinese beer, or tropical fruits. Minot was resourceful and street smart. His earliest memory of Haesam was the famine, and it had toughened him. But, like me, he was stubborn. Once he set his mind on a course of action, it was difficult to change. I should have felt happy for him. Yunji, my mother had told me, was incredibly beautiful. When she had turned 18, special scouts that selected musicians and beautiful girls to attend upon Kim Jong-il came to her school and singled her out to join the Dear Leader's Joy Division. But to prevent her being taken away, Yunji's mother had pretended that her daughter had health problems. Minho said he'd help Omar get into China, but that he was staying behind. Yunji's mother worked for the Puibu, he said. He believed this would protect him. The family could be trusted with our secret. There was nothing more I could say. It was clear that Minho felt strongly about this girl. I started a plan. My first step was to contact the Reverend Kim, a middle-aged Protestant pastor whose organization demonstrated in Insadong, a popular market area of Seoul, every Saturday for North Korean human rights. Rowdy demonstrations are part of everyday life in Seoul. Any time I'd go downtown, I'd see a lone protester outside a government building with a placard advertising his grievance, or workers with slogans on their headbands singing songs and punching the air. The first time I saw them, I was amazed. Citizens here could shout out their complaints without being arrested and publicly executed. Using his contacts in China, Reverend Kim had helped hundreds of people escape. His specialty was shepherding defectors through the southwestern Chinese city of Kunming and over the border into Vietnam, from where they could make their way to the South Korean embassy. The journey across China is more than 2,000 miles and takes a week. It is dangerous, so much so that some escapers carry poison with them to kill themselves if they're caught, rather than face the consequences of being returned to the north. As South Korea does not wish to antagonize China by accepting North Korean asylum seekers at its embassy in Beijing and its consulates throughout China, it colludes with the Chinese authorities in keeping them away. Even if a defector makes it through an embassy gate, that person may have a very long wait. Some have waited 7 years before China has granted permission for them to leave. I found Reverend Kim on the sidewalk at one of his Saturday protests. Over the noisy chanting of a sit-down demonstration, he told me that my mother would have to cross the Yalu River by herself, but that he could guide her from that point onward. It would cost $4,000. Alternatively, she could make her own way across China to Kunming and be guided from there to the South Korean embassy in Vietnam. That would cost $2,000. She would be in the hands of a Chinese broker arranged by him. I thanked him and took his phone number, but I had a sinking feeling. Brokers. That evening, I mulled this over in my apartment. Kim called and asked what I'd done with my day. I opened my mouth to tell him and changed my mind. He would not understand. He would tell me it was insanely dangerous and wonder why I wasn't content to let things be. He understood little about North Korea. It was the same with his friends. Most of them did not want to think about the North, let alone talk about it. I would see a shutter come down behind their eyes if I mentioned it. The North was their mad uncle in the attic, a subject best avoided. I had hoped Reverend Kim could somehow avoid using brokers, but I knew that even humanitarian organizations had to rely on some unsavory characters at a local level. As these brokers were breaking the law and their motivation was money, they were seldom trustworthy or pleasant. If a situation turned dangerous, they'd vanish like the morning mist and leave their clients in the hands of the police, or worse. I would never forgive myself if that happened to my mother, if she were returned to the North. After talking it over with Oki, I decided to use the broker only for the very final part of the journey, getting out of China. I would go to Changbai and meet my mother on the riverbank. I would guide her across China to Kunming myself. Chapter 42. A Place of Ghosts and Wild Dogs. I pressed the bell, feeling that familiar flutter of nerves. Suddenly I was 17 again, standing outside this very door, at the start of my adventure. I shivered. It was much colder in northern China than it was in Seoul. I was wearing a thick hooded sweatshirt, jeans, sneakers, and carried all my stuff in a backpack. I heard someone coming, and a latch jangling.
My goodness,
my aunt said, looking me up and down.
You've changed. You were only a girl when I saw you last.
The difference in her appearance surprised me, too. She had become an old lady, thin and stooped, with swollen rheumatic fingers. It immediately made me think how much older my mother must have become. My aunt invited me in. She had redecorated the apartment and showed me around. The guitar was still in my old room. My uncle was away on business, she said. I had long repaid the debt I owed him and had stayed in touch. I hoped time had healed the hurt I caused all those years ago when I fled this place to avoid marrying Gunsu. I'd heard that he'd married and was glad for him. It had released me from my penance never to marry. I wondered whether he had provided his fearsome mother with the grandchildren she'd wanted. I didn't dare ask. My aunt was warm and welcoming. It was clear that all was forgiven, if not forgotten. I was relieved, because I needed her help again. And it was a big favor to ask.
My ID card?
She was taken aback. I lowered my eyes. I'll mail it back to you in 2 weeks' time. For my plan to work, I needed to borrow a genuine Chinese ID that my mother could use. When I explained this, my aunt laughed. I was grateful for that laugh.
Well, I suppose so.
I had timed everything finely and couldn't stay long at my aunt's. Having taken her ID, I told her apologetically that I had to leave immediately. She shook her head, gave me 500 yuan, about $75, and wished me all the luck in the world. Within an hour, I was on an overnight coach to Changbai. I stowed my aunt's ID carefully in my wallet. I had enough cash with me for the broker's fee, for food, accommodation, and travel. The money was the last of my savings from Shanghai. I'd been living off that and my small monthly stipend of 350,000 won, $320, from the South Korean government. It was now the end of September 2009. All going well, in 2 weeks' time I would be back in Seoul, and my mother, a shudder of apprehension and excitement ran through me, my dear Omar, would be safe in the South Korean embassy in Ho Chi Minh City, claiming asylum. This meant I would still have enough time to take the entrance exams and attend interviews at any universities that had accepted my application for the 2010 academic year beginning the following spring. Mr. Park, the policeman, had warned me to be extremely wary.
Tell nobody you're a defector.
There had been cases of Chinese police handing defectors over to the Puibu, even though they were travelling on valid South Korean passports. So as soon as I'd passed through immigration at Shenyang, I hid my South Korean passport and took out my old Chinese ID. This made me feel safer. It was 3 a.m. by the time I arrived in Changbai. I checked into a two-star hotel to make preparations. Once Minou had brought my mother across, my plan was to have a few days vacation with them both before Minou returned to Haesan. To help them blend in as Chinese, I brought some trousers for him and some colourful, good-quality clothes for my mother, who would have to throw away any North Korean-made items. I went to several hotels in the town to see which would be safest and decided on the Changbai Bingwan, the hotel with the largest lobby, and where we wouldn't have to walk past the reception desk every time we came and went. It was also the most expensive hotel in town, and the last place Chinese police or Puibu agents would expect to find an escaped North Korean. I checked in the next day and took a room with two double beds. Minou had confirmed the plan. He would bring our mother over the next evening between 7 and 8 p.m. He told me where on the river they would cross. I knew the spot. There was a derelict house on the Chinese side. My mother had prepared her departure ingeniously. If she had done what most escaping families did, leave everything and disappear, the authorities would come after Mino. But she also knew that if she sold the house, the authorities would still want to know where she'd gone. Either way, Mino would be questioned. To preempt this, she sold her house and told the city authorities that she was moving to Hamhung, However, instead of registering her residency in Hamhung, she bribed a hospital doctor there to file her death certificate and funeral documents. If the Puibu investigated, it would appear as if she had died en route to Hamhung. At 6:15 p.m. next evening, I began to get ready. I was frightened, yet strangely exhilarated, my senses sharpened, my body tense with nervous energy. I set my phone to silent, dressed myself entirely in black, picked up the bag in which I put the new clothes for my mother and Minho, and walked calmly and purposefully through the hotel lobby. Outside, I hailed a cab and directed the driver to take me to the point where the town ended, about 200 yards from the river. There, at the end of a row of low buildings, was the derelict house among the trees. I crouched down behind an old garden wall and waited. The place was cold and damp and smelled of mouldering leaves and animal droppings. I peeped over the wall and saw North Korean border patrols passing on the opposite bank. In the halftones beneath the trees, I felt camouflaged. The sunset looked ominous, a palette of murky reds and yellows. On the other side of the water, Haesan seemed lifeless, a city dug from rock, or an intricate cemetery, a place of ghosts and wild dogs. I felt no nostalgia for it, only defiance. I dare you not to give me my mother. An icy breeze lifted swirls of leaves and sent wavelets lapping across the surface of the river. If I hadn't felt so alive with nerves and excitement, I would have found somewhere warmer to wait. It was too cold to stand still. Not long now. I'm about to meet my Omar again. I could hardly believe this was happening. Minho had told me he would lead her waist-high through the water and help her up one of the ladders on the Chinese bank. The water must be freezing. I checked the time on my phone every minute for an hour. At 8 p.m, there was still no sign of them. A keening cry from a night bird made me jump. A quarter of an hour later, night had fallen like a cloud of ash. I could see nothing on the other side of the river. The power was out in Haesan. The blood was no longer circulating in my hands and feet. The temperature was dropping by the minute. I didn't know whether my teeth were chattering from cold or panic. Where are they? Another hour went by. Then out of the darkness, someone called, "Yeah!" My heart went into overdrive. Along the North Korean bank, a beam of light was bouncing on the dirt track. Border guards, patrolling in pairs, greeting another patrol. They were passing every 2 minutes. I didn't remember there being so many guards. They were just 50 yards away from me. I could hear their conversation. One patrol had a dog, which turned its head towards me and barked, setting off a dozen other dogs. A memory came to me, long suppressed, of seeing blood on ice one morning. A failed escape. I put my hands to my ears. If the dogs would stop barking... My phone was buzzing. Mino's voice was fast and tense. "We've had a problem." Chapter 43. An Impossible Dilemma. Quickly, Minho explained that just as he and my mother had been about to cross, they had walked straight into a border guard. Luckily, he was someone Minho did business with. The guard told him there was a general alert out for a high-ranking family from Pyongyang who were attempting to escape this very night. There were extra guards all along the river, he said, as well as Puibu agents. The whole area was in lockdown. The guard then asked Minho to stay a while and keep him company while he kept a lookout. At that moment, my mother had said goodnight and had walked away. Minho said he and my mother would try again to cross just before dawn. I returned to Changbai. It was now midnight. The town was deserted, and alone in the dark, I felt exposed. I was too nervous to sleep, so I found an all-night diner. I ordered a bowl of bean paste stew and went over what Minho had said. I couldn't believe this. I had picked the worst possible night of the year to bring my mother across, and it was already going horribly wrong. I will myself to stay calm and to think clearly. In a few hours, everything will be all right. I couldn't finish the stew. I went back to the hotel and tried to doze for a while in my clothes. I must have drifted off, because the next thing I knew, the phone was buzzing next to my face. "We'll be there at 6, Minot said. I jumped off the bed. Minutes later, as I was in the taxi, he called again. "We're across. We're hiding in the derelict house." I was elated. I had not seen my dear mother in 11 years, 9 months, and 9 days. Now I was minutes away from her. I asked the driver to wait and walked across the rough ground toward the riverbank. The sky to the east was turning a faint duck-egg blue. Then, there, about 50 yards ahead, next to the derelict house, I made out the silhouettes of 2 figures. They were walking at a crouch, coming toward me. My Omar. In the half-light, I saw a strained, old face and a body moving very stiffly. Minot was behind her, protective and guiding with his arm around her. I ran to meet them, but there was no time for a reunion. "We have to go," I said. We were exposed between the river and the town. At daybreak, the Chinese border guards would start patrolling. The taxi driver, who I hoped was waiting out of sight on the road, might have got out and been watching. He could report us. I pulled out the clothes I had brought for them. "Put these on, over what you're wearing, quick." Once they were dressed, I led them towards the taxi. "Act normal, but don't speak. He'll think you're locals." We got into the taxi. In case the driver reported us, I asked him to take us to a different hotel. We sat in silence for the 10-minute ride. I paid the fare. It wasn't customary to tip, but I didn't ask for the change. We got out, and once he'd driven away, walked to the Chiang Bai Bingwan. It was so early that no one was around. The lobby was empty, and the sole receptionist was engrossed in her cell phone. Once I put my mother and brother in the elevator and told them to go to the room, I went over to the desk. "Hey there," I said, sounding casual. "The lady's with me. I'll bring her ID when we come down for breakfast. The man's not staying. He'll go soon."
"Fine," she said, stifling a yawn.
I closed the hotel room door behind me. For a moment, we looked at each other. Half a lifetime had passed since the 3 of us had been together. No one could speak. Then my mother broke down, and all her tension released. I held her. A lump rose to my throat. I had never felt such extremes of joy and sadness at the same time. She was weeping uncontrollably. Over her shoulder, Mino's face looked immensely sad. He'd shared her pain all these years, and soon he would say goodbye to her and probably never see her again. We stepped back to stare at each other, taking in the changes in our faces, the ravages of time. My mother looked helpless and frail. My mind still held the image of her face that night I'd last seen her. She was 42 then, and a woman of so much energy she could hardly sit still. Now she was 54, but she looked much older. She was far thinner than I remembered, and her mouth was drawn and lined. They were both different. Minot was a grown man. I could see the strength in his shoulders and arms. 8 years had passed since that brief reunion with him at Mr. Arne's house, cut short by the gang. He kept his feelings bottled up, as our father had, but his eyes brimmed with tears at the sight of our mother's distress. Her hands were shaking, touching my face, then touching her own face, then mine again.
"Omar,"
I said. She saw the concern in my eyes.
"I've aged 12 years in the last 12 hours, she said.
I laughed and hugged her again. She'd always made fun of her own appearance. As I held her, I suddenly remembered the clothes she had on underneath were icy and soaking wet.
They were both visibly more relaxed after a hot shower, but I was back in worry mode. We were not safe. I had to stay in control and be vigilant. By far the most dangerous part of the plan lay ahead.
"Why are you so spotty?"
my mother said, as if no time had passed. It was exactly the comment she would have made when I was 17. The stress of the preparations had wreaked havoc with my complexion.
"If I'd known, I'd have brought Bingdu for you."
Crystal meth. "I don't think so, Omar.
It's great for your skin. Mix it with water, wash your face with it, and it'll clear up in no time."
"I use it for night driving," Mino said. There was no point debating this with them now. Two separate worlds were colliding in this room. Mino had put on the new jeans and top I'd bought for him. He looked handsome. My brother. I did not want to think about our imminent goodbye. None of us had been to bed, but no one felt like sleeping. I wanted to know what had happened last night. After they'd run into the border guard on the riverbank, my mother had gone to wait at a friend's house nearby. Mino had kept the guard company for a few hours, then gone back to Yunji's house, where he'd been living with her and her parents prior to the marriage. The wedding plans were underway, but a date had not yet been set.
"You should have stayed together," I said, looking at both of them.
"I couldn't let Yunji know I was helping Omar escape," Mino said. "If their relationship ever went sour, this fact could be fatal for him."
"If we come over last night, I was just going to call her and say I was here on business and would be back in a day or two. She was still asleep when I left this morning. I wrote her a note."
Two guards had been patrolling when Mino had returned to the riverbank with my mother just before dawn. They asked him who the woman was. He told them she was a client meeting someone in China and would be coming back.
"I told them she was paying me big money, so I'll have to give them something when I go back."
Mino hesitated, and I saw worry in his eyes.
"The funny thing was, while we were talking, more guards appeared. They were relieving the guards on duty further up the path. Suddenly there were nine of them who'd stopped to talk. Some of them tried to persuade me not to cross with this woman. They trusted me, but they didn't know who she was. 'Leave her behind,' they said. So we got delayed a bit while I argued with them."
I told him he should have waited until they'd gone.
"It was getting light, and I didn't want to run into a Chinese patrol on the other side. Anyway, the guys all know me. It's not a problem. I just said goodbye and crossed."
The group of nine guards watched as he took my mother's hand and waded waist-deep with her through the water. The irony was all too much. I started giggling and couldn't stop. The border crossing is the most dangerous moment for anyone attempting to escape. But my brother and mother had been waved off by every armed border guard along that stretch of the river. Next thing I knew, all three of us were weeping with laughter. As we went down in the elevator the next morning, I told my mother and Mino not to speak too loudly at breakfast. I would say something to them in Mandarin from time to time. Otherwise, we'd keep quiet and not draw attention by speaking Korean. I was worried that Mino stood out. He was the youngest person in the hotel. The other guests were middle-aged or elderly. After breakfast, we ventured out, disciplining ourselves to say as little as possible. Even though many people in Chiang Mai spoke Korean as a first language, strong North Korean accents would be conspicuous. We went shopping at a market so that I could show them the wealth of goods on display. Then I took them to lunch at an upmarket Korean restaurant. I figured, again, that this was the last place anyone would expect to spot escaped North Koreans. But I also wanted to treat them. Soon Mino would be leaving us, and I wanted us all to have a wonderful memory of our last time together. Back in the hotel room, Mino turned his cell phone on. It rang straight away. It was Yunji. She was shouting the moment he answered. My mother and I could hear every word.
"Where are you? Who's the bitch you were with?"
"Why?"
"Don't you know what's happening?"
"Calm down. What's the matter?"
"Everyone is going crazy here. The senior guard who let you across is here at the house. He's in a panic."
Why?
Someone informed his commander that you'd gone across with a woman. The commander says if you come back with her right now, you'll be all right. But if you come back alone, you'll be in deep trouble. And so will the guard for letting you cross. They'll accuse you of human trafficking.
Minot's eyes bulge in disbelief.
The guard is here. He's begging me to make you come. Right now, she said. And who's this bloody woman you crossed with?
She's visiting relatives.
Minot sounded evasive, sheepish. Well, why didn't you just take her across and come back?
She's paying me a big fee.
We've got money. Why take such a risk for this bitch?
Don't say that.
Bring her back, she shouted.
I'll call you later.
He hung up and collapsed onto the bed with his hands over his face. My mother and I had heard everything. Minot was in an impossible dilemma. The worst of his life. He had to go back, but couldn't return with my mother, or they'd ask what she was doing in China. The answer could only be to meet me. If he went back alone, he'd be accused of human trafficking and interrogated. The Puibu would break him and quickly get to the truth, that he was helping his mother to defect. He'd face political prison, a zone of no return. His life would be over. I went to the window and my forehead hit the glass with a thump. Not in any of the disaster scenarios I'd envisaged had I imagined a complication such as this. For several minutes we said nothing, sunk in our own thoughts. I broke the silence.
Mino, if you go back, you'll be in terrible trouble, I said, speaking slowly and evenly.
Mino looked as if he'd been cast in wax. My mother said nothing.
If you both go back, it'll be worse. Omar can't go back with you.
That leaves us two choices. We can hope that your connections with the guards will get you out of this. I was talking to him, but he made no sign that he was hearing me. The other choice is don't go back. My words filled the room. Your friend the guard will be finished. I'm very sorry about him. But we're your family. Mino, you can't go back. You just can't. It'll be so dangerous. You have to come with us. I hadn't planned for this, but we'll figure it out somehow. I knew there was no choice, but I had to let him decide. Both options were extremely risky. Mino would have to travel across China as an illegal. Also, I had budgeted for my mother and for the broker's fee, but didn't think I had enough money for him, too. I had no confidence we could all make it. But if he really thought he could go back, brazen it out, and bribe his way out of the problem, it had to be his own decision. Mino was in shock.
I can't go back.
His voice was a whisper.
We all know that.
I took his hand and my mother's hand and held them. We'll leave together. We'll do the best we can. His phone rang. Yunji again.
Are you on your way? She asked.
It's going to take me one more day, he said quietly.
He was buying time to figure out how he was going to tell her. Her parents liked him and had connections that could help him. But if they thought he was running out on her, they also had the power to stop him getting far. The Puibu were permitted to operate in China to track down escapers.
You've got to come back, she cried.
We could hear her weeping. She sensed he wasn't going to come. In the morning, we decided to leave Changbai as fast as possible. Mino was dreading turning on his phone. It rang within seconds. Yunji was calling again. She was calmer now. She said she had a feeling that he wasn't coming back. Her parents were in the room with her.
Tell me, the woman you're with, is she really a stranger? Or is she your mother? Just say the truth.
She's my mother, he said. My sister came for her. That's why I crossed.
Her parents had figured it out. She started crying again.
Mino, please come back,
She was begging him. You left me a note, but all the time you knew you were going for good. How could you leave me sleeping without saying goodbye?
My mother clasped her hand to her mouth. This was breaking her heart. Mino's lip trembled.
Please, believe me, I wanted to go back. I still do. But I can't take Omar back. So how can I go back alone now?
Check the money in the drawer. It's all there. If I were going for good, would I leave it all there?
I believe you, she said. Just come back.
Mino?
A man's voice now. Stern. Yunji's father.
Please return right away. I'm begging you for Yunji.
Mino didn't answer. He was breathing deeply. The look on his face was one I remembered from when he was a little boy and wished something wasn't happening to him. I took the phone from his hand. This is Mino's sister, I said, hearing the coolness in my voice. We want him to go back. He wants to go back. Whatever he does now is dangerous. But please understand that returning now is the more dangerous option.
I know it's a serious problem, he said, but we will do whatever we can, whatever the cost to take care of this.
Good. Thank you. We will also try to think of a way, I said. Let's speak again tomorrow. I could hear Yunji in the background crying almost hysterically. I ended the call. The scale of this disaster was clear. These two were in love. I turned off the phone, and without expecting to, burst into tears. I was exhausted. I looked over at my mother, who had remained silent this whole time. I could only imagine the guilt she was feeling. She had been the rock of our lives, always able to solve any problem, fix any situation. Now she could only watch as her children struggled with the calamity that had struck just a day after our reunion.
I'm going to take a shower, Mino said.
My mother shot me a puzzled look. He closed the bathroom door. We heard him turn on the taps and flush the toilet. Then the shower came on with a hiss. My mother and I glanced at one another, and then we looked down. We could hear him sobbing. It was agonizing to hear. He had nothing left but his body and the clothes on his back. His mother and sister could do nothing. No words would be enough. A few minutes later, he came out, dressed and toweling his hair dry. We pretended we hadn't heard. He had regained some composure.
So, Nuna, what's the plan?
He'd called me older sister on the phone, but it was gratifying to hear it from him in person. We're leaving this town in under an hour. Chapter 44 Journey into Night. I left Mino with my mother in the hotel room while I went to the coach station to buy tickets. Outside in the bustle of the town, I seethed with nerves, as if everyone I passed was reaching for their phones to call the Puibu. At the station, I realized what was unsettling me. There were police everywhere. Security police in navy uniforms. People's armed police in olive green uniforms. What was going on? When I asked for the tickets, the woman at the counter held out her hand.
Your ID and those of the other travellers.
This was a surprise. IDs.
It's National Day, she said flatly, in case you hadn't noticed.
That explained the police. It was the 1st of October. Nor was it any ordinary National Day. This was 2009. The 60th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. There was always heightened vigilance on this date to prevent anything marring the celebrations. But the 60th was considered so prosperous an anniversary that security was at maximum. I gazed about in disbelief. Not only had I picked the worst possible night for my mother to cross the river, I'd picked the worst day in a decade to travel.
Mino, could you borrow an ID from someone in Chiang Bai? Anyone?
Mino said he could try a few business contacts. The first man ran a used motorcycle shop. He came out as he saw us approach, wiping his hands on an oily stained T-shirt.
"What are you doing here? Who's she?"
was his greeting. He wasn't fat, but his posture was so slouched that his gut hung over his belt. Mino said that he was buying family gifts for Chuseok, the Korean harvest festival that was 2 days away. He introduced me as a cousin from Shenyang and said he wanted to go to Shenyang but needed to borrow an ID for a few days.
"If I lend it to you and you get into trouble, what am I supposed to do?"
Mino had told me this man was honest, but a born coward when it came to bending the rules. "Report it stolen," I said. He puffed out his cheeks and shook his head slowly. Mino's second contact was a motorcycle parts trader, a friendly man with a patchy beard. We took him for lunch and gave him the same pretext. I also offered to pay him 1,000 yuan, $150, and to return the card to him in a week's time.
"What if you get caught?" he said, lighting a cigarette.
"Say you lost the card and get a new one." He blew out a mixture of laughter, nerves and smoke.
"There were an awful lot of cops around. They're checking everyone."
I could see that he wanted to say no. Instead, he said,
"Give me a day. I'll think about it."
We had no choice but to wait. I went to Mrs. Ahn's house to see if she could help. The house was boarded up. A neighbour said that she had moved away. We were out of options. It would have to be the second trader or nothing. In the meantime, I had to book another expensive night at the hotel. I was back in one of those tight corners where I found myself closing my eyes and muttering to my ancestors, beseeching, desperate, asking for their help. But I expected no miracles. Our predicament seemed hopeless. The trader called the next morning as we were eating breakfast.
"I'm scared shitless about this, but Mino has helped me make a lot of money. I owe him."
When we had the ID in our hands, I noticed that the man's age was 38. Mino was 22 and looked nothing like him. Still, it was the gender that counted. I figured that's all the police would look at. The card was also in a different format from mine. It was in both Chinese and Korean scripts, which I'd never seen before. The parts trader told us the police had launched a massive nationwide social cleanup campaign prior to the 60th anniversary celebrations. Travellers were facing checks and roadblocks everywhere. The sensible thing would have been to wait 2 weeks until things had calmed down, but I didn't have enough money. We had to move. I did not want to panic my mother and Mino. I reassured them that I had faith in our good luck. If fortune was with us, we'd be protected no matter what. If it wasn't, there was nothing we could do. At the coach station, I bought 3 160 yuan, $25, tickets for the coach leaving at 2 p.m. the next day. It had sleeper bunks on 2 levels and in 3 rows, split by 2 aisles. I asked for the 3 bunks at the back of the bus on the 2nd level. My hope was that if the coach was stopped, the police would come through and collect all the IDs. At the back, they would neither see us nor check closely that the IDs were ours. The coach left on time. Our epic journey had begun. My stomach tightened with trepidation, but I was also hopeful. Getting that ID for Mino made me think fortune had turned our way. We travelled southwest out of the town, along the Yalu River. The first leg of the journey, to Shenyang, was about 250 miles. It wound through hilly countryside and would take 12 hours. I held my camera up to the window. I had taken a few shots of Haesan the previous day. This fleeting view would probably be the last time I'd ever see the place. It made me reflective and sad, glimpsing the high white wall of our old home on the riverbank. I thought of far-off days in spring, before the famine, when my father skimmed stones with us across the water, when the world beyond the river had seemed vast and mysterious. The coach passed the customs post at the end of the Friendship Bridge. I took a few last pictures. Then, less than 5 minutes into our journey,
The coach slowed and pulled over. We leaned into the aisle to see what was happening. The hydraulic door opened with a hiss. A soldier in green uniform and cap climbed in, carrying an automatic rifle. I felt my guts coil. I looked out of the window on Minot's side. A group of People's Armed Police was manning what looked like a temporary checkpoint. Jeeps were parked along both sides of the road ahead. The soldier moved down the aisle. He was not demanding IDs. He was checking people's eyes, looking each passenger in the face. Why? For signs of nervousness? For anyone who doesn't belong? It was only at that moment that I realized Minot was the only man on the coach. Every other passenger was a woman. Minot did not even look Chinese. He was weathered and had darker skin than Chinese men his age. Sunblock is unheard of in North Korea. In the street earlier, I'd given him my baseball cap to keep the sun off his face. Now he had pulled it over his eyes and pretended to be asleep. The soldier moved slowly, taking in each face. I could hear my heart pounding in my ears. He had now checked more than half of the passengers. I glanced at the bridge with its flags flying. I could see North Korean guards on the far side. The soldier was just feet away. He met my eye. Then he spotted Minot. It seemed to happen in slow motion. I swung my legs off the berth and blocked the aisle. I felt something metal and hard in my hand. It was my camera. Without thinking, I pointed it at the soldier's face and took a picture. Somehow the flash was on.
"Hey, hey, hey,"
he said. Then I swung around and pointed it through the window and started snapping pictures of the armed police at the checkpoint. He grabbed my arm.
"No photos."
"Oh!" I smiled stupidly with my hand over my mouth. "Sorry, you look awesome in your uniforms." Behind him, I noticed that every passenger on the coach had craned their heads into the aisle to watch.
"It's illegal. Delete them now."
"Aw," I said, sounding put out. "Can't I keep this one?"
"No, now, quickly."
The passengers all looked like locals from Chiang Mai. I looked like a girl from somewhere foreign and fashionable. With luck, they all thought I was some clueless tourist. The soldier was embarrassed and annoyed. He knew the whole coach was watching. "Here's the one of you," I said. His face looked blanched and stunned. "Look, I'm deleting it." Then he turned and stomped down the aisle to escape the stairs. The automatic door closed behind him. I slumped back into my berth. What just happened? I had a sensation of coming back to reality, as if I'd just come off stage and the performance had left me exhausted. We had more than 2,000 miles ahead of us. How often would this happen? For the rest of the journey to Shenyang, we lay in our berths without speaking. When the sun set, the other passengers also settled into sleep beneath rough blankets. I lay awake listening to the hum of the engine as the road unrolled endlessly from the darkness. I was too unnerved to sleep. My mind was running far ahead of the coach, probing for danger. Chapter 45. Under a Vast Asian Sky. My aunt had wanted me